Hi, everybody.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Larry.
I'm Larry, a fellow traveler. Thank you, George, for asking me to speak, I think. This has been speaking in front of people. It's been one of those things that my, was a huge PTSD thing for me. And it you know, my earlier life, and I now, you know, perform for a living as a musician. So I've had a chance over the years to keep pushing that boundary, that moving, you know, into that discomfort zone. But, and it's much better these days. But it did, to be honest, it's still a lot of stuff came up around sharing tonight. And I decided to share a song with you that's an original song that's very personal and that kind of added to the whole thing. But I'm feeling much better about it. So anyway, I'll share my story with you. I grew up in a large family. My father was the alcoholic. He was a World War II vet, and we were a Catholic family, and which accounts for the fact that we had 9 children altogether. I was the third. There was a lot that happened in the first 3 or 4 years, about which I had virtually no memory, and I'll share a little bit about that. In a little bit, but that's kind of a lot that happened there that kind of laid the foundation. But I had no memory for a reason. It was blocked from my memory. But the earliest memories I did have, there was a lot of anger and hatred and cruelty from my father and my older brother, and I was sort of a favorite child, I think, of my mother's. You know, there was a little bit of favoritism there, and that I think my father and my older brother picked up on that, and it triggered their jealousy and anger and hatred, and they acted that out in pretty serious ways. But the things that I had memory of, you know, there was a lot that they taunted me a lot, or, you know, tormented me, and were cruel in different ways. I had various ways of reacting to life that I had no understanding of at the time. I had a lot of terror, you know, and anxiety, but was not connected to the source of that. And I could not, you know, at that time as a child, and back in those days, you didn't really identify feelings, you know, no one talked about them, so none of that was ever dealt with. So there was just, you know, my father was a rageaholic a lot of the time. And my brother and I pretty much always shared a bedroom, at least, and if not had like bunk beds, we were close together. So it was kind of open season, you know, when he felt jealous or angry with me, you know, he had a perfect place to act it out, you know. So in school, I had went to a Catholic school until about 9th grade. And had a lot of trouble with the nuns. I had one particular nun in like 7th grade, maybe 6th or 7th grade, who kind of zeroed in on me for some reason. I think because, you know, she had a really sadistic side to her, and decided that she was going to break my spirit. I asked questions. You know, we had catechism class in which they taught us exactly what to believe about God, and, you know, everything the church taught, and I had, you know, thought maybe maybe we shouldn't just accept all that for, as it's being taught. Maybe questions came up and I voiced those questions, so I was zeroed in on as somebody who was threatening the status quo. And so she kind of made it her obsession to break my spirit. And so that whole time, which was about a year, you know, two semesters in class there, she took that out on me, and it was pretty rough a lot of the time. She was really good at being sadistic, you know, and there was a lot of repression around sexuality, you know, anything sexual. I remember having to go to confession, and you kind of had it drilled into you that if whatever you had to even confess your so-called impure thoughts, you know, it meant anything the least bit sexual. And so there was just a lot of shame and guilt that was kind of imprinted or, you know, transferred to me and all of us, you know, everybody. And then my mother was particularly, she had, you know, her brand of 50s Catholicism was particularly, you know, conservative. She had a lot of uptightness around anything sexual. And I think probably too, like, you know, her relationship with my father was not very good. He was not, he was verbally abusive to her, but not physically, but sometimes physically abusive to us, you know, with spankings and that kind of thing. So I think she kind of retreated into the security of her religious beliefs and the safety of the church. But she communicated that her own shame and feelings around sexuality especially were transferred to us and to me particularly, because I think she communicated to me that she, because my father was kind of macho and abusive in his own way, a rageaholic, and his drinking was escalating. He was a bit of a womanizer. I don't know how much of that went on when I was young, but it definitely escalated later. So she, I think she kind of had this obsession with molding me into the kind of male that she wanted, which was kind of a eunuch. It was sort of it was a kind of a sexual abuse, but not overtly sexual. There's a word for that. I can't think of it right now. Anyways, all of that influenced me. So, you know, the getting the approval of both of them was like really conflicting, you know. The one side of me that wanted to prove myself, I had a desperate need for approval from my father and my brother, my brother's friends, and I would go back to them again and again and get abused, you know, verbally at that time. And somehow hoping that it would change, they would, you know, just get a moment's kindness or acceptance, but it never happened, you know. And then with my mother, it was like I had to be this kind of asexual, sort of a surrogate lover. She was sort of a confidant of hers, you know. I had you know, a series of girlfriends and that I sort of fell into. I wasn't assertive in that way. I just sort of, you know, they kind of gravitated to me and found myself, you know, being the boyfriend of somebody. But, you know, that experience was acutely uncomfortable for me. It was like agonizingly uncomfortable. And usually what would happen is I would sort of withdraw into myself and get so, my fear, my terror was up actually, and I couldn't identify it as that, but it caused me to sort of implode inside myself. I became very passive and withdrawn and would eventually sort of just passively back out of these relationships. And it happened like, you know, many, many different times. And each one of those was really painful because I didn't know what was going on. I didn't want to do that, but I felt no alternative. I had this feeling of utter dread and fear, and some impending doom was going to happen, and I didn't know what it was. Later, you know, I did find out, and I'll get into that. But Anyway, toward the end, I was also, you know, starting to play music. Music was like a love of mine, but in there as well, when I played in front of people, I played in some bands, and, you know, like starting around ninth grade. But, again, the experience was so agonizing that just, you know, if the attention was on me, if I had a solo or something, I would lock up. I would get like rigor mortis, and it was not fun. And yet I love music, but I just could not do it in front of people. So eventually there I gave up as well, and backed out of both trying to have relationships with girls and playing music. And yet, you know, both of those things were things I really wanted, you know, but felt no alternative and didn't know what to do. But I, somewhere in about 11th or 12th grade, I was interested in spirituality. I've been raised Catholic. I left the church, you know, a year or two earlier, and was gravitating toward Eastern religions. It was about the time that Transcendental Meditation became popular, and I thought, you know, oh, this is like, you know, this is a new, something different than Catholicism, and it sounded like it was the thing that was going to fix me. And so I started Transcendental Meditation. What I found, though, was that just sitting and being quiet, I was like alone, I was present with my feelings. And so, one experience I had that kind of illustrates what happened, I had this girlfriend who was, had started to drive. I didn't have a driver's license yet. She was going to come by to pick me up to go somewhere, you know, to go out somewhere. And my brother and I, because we had so many kids, we, instead of building on an extra room, they put us into a trailer behind the house. We had kind of like a ranch house that we lived on. And I was in this, you know, in the room there, you know, it was dark, and I was supposedly meditating. And knowing that she was coming to pick me up, and my mother came to the back door and said something, and I was so in such a state of fear, and I had this gnawing pain in my gut, like an ulcer or something. I was paralyzed with fear. So, and I didn't even answer. I just let, you know, this girl came, and then my mother couldn't find me, didn't know where I was, so I didn't answer. So she left, you know. And all of that sort of increased my sense of shame, like there's something really wrong with me, and I can't even talk about it. Nobody else is like this, you know. But I couldn't identify any of the feelings that were going on or anything. Eventually, I continued in that pursuit of like Eastern spirituality and meditation, and found a group that a different organization that I really kind of fell in love with, and the teaching and everything. And there was, you know, taught about a higher power, loving a higher power, as well as meditation, and all of that I thought was gonna fix me and save me. And it sounded so incredible, and the whole notion of self-realization, or, you know, all the words that you just, you know, bliss consciousness, whatever you use, whatever words you use to describe it. And I actually, my older brother and I decided to become monks in that organization, which I did, and was there for, you know, they had like a postulant monastery or ashram, they called it, and I was only lasted about maybe 3 or 4 months, and I was having all kinds of physical issues coming on, digestive problems, back problems, and they asked me to leave until I got those things resolved. Anyway, I ended up living with some other members of this organization, sort of trying to live like a monk, but out in the world, near one of their temples in LA, in Hollywood. And during that time, all my stomach symptoms, all those physical symptoms became worse. And I became more desperate as to what to do about that, you know. And I prayed about it, and I believed I was being guided by higher power, by God, to do certain things that seemed to relieve the symptoms temporarily, and I thought that's what I had to do to be healed, you know. And I thought, you know, this is going to take some huge willingness to go to any lengths. And so what I started doing was fasting more and more, and I was like compulsively exercising and was working full time. I was pushing myself to the limit on like less and less food, and I was losing weight pretty rapidly, and eventually, in going to work every day, I worked for the publications building of this organization that I was a part of, and their print shop, and finally one of their supervisors there, who was one of their monks, who was actually one of the, you know, somebody who had some real capacity for compassion and cared about me enough to bring me into his office and ask me what was going on, and I told him everything was fine. You know, yeah, I was losing weight, but I'm taking care of it. So I got everything covered. Don't worry. And anyway, the next time he called me and he heard me talking along those lines, I would think I was a little bit more out there, you know, kind of maybe approaching maybe even psychosis. I mean, it was pretty delusional, you know, partly from malnutrition maybe. But anyway, to his credit, he said, you know, okay, you know, there's something not okay here. And he insisted I go to their doctor, which I did, and I was barely, you know, able to function, but I got to this doctor, and the doctor took a look at me, and I don't remember if he did any tests or not, but he said, if you continue doing what you're doing, you will be dead in 2 weeks, a month, it's not a very long time. And fortunately, I was not actually trying to kill myself, you know, it got my attention, and this was sort of my first big bottom, you might say. They were going to put me in a hospital, and they contacted my mother, found out, and wanted to have me come home where they would do the same thing, which is frequent feedings and vitamins and that kind of thing. And by the time I got back to my family's home, I just turned into a vegetable. So this whole routine that I'd been on, I'd been like driving myself for months, suddenly ground to a halt, and my brain turned to mush. I could barely even, you know, all I could do was like sit in a chair on the front lawn and just like, you know. But during that period, it was kind of like everything I believed or thought I knew about why I was doing what I was doing, but you know, that all kind of came crashing down, and I prayed to just be shown like why did this happen? You know, what's wrong? What's wrong with me or what? That prayer was answered. It took a while, but I did gain my weight back, and I never sort of felt like I was fully functional again, but I tried to go back to work, I tried to go to school part-time, both of those things fell apart. I had new physical problems coming up, like a prostatitis, a bladder infection, just stuff. And most of the stuff was in the area of my digestion or, you know, my groin, or that area of my body. I even had my mother had me go in for a test. They gave me like a barium, not an enema, where you drink, it shows, you do an x-ray of your stomach and the whole digestive tract. The solution or whatever it is, the barium, I guess it is, that they gave me to drink, went as far as my stomach and it stopped. It wouldn't pass through. We waited, and I was like lying on the table. The doctor's going, "Wow, I've never seen this before." So it was just it showing something was like seriously wrong. You know, there was like fear gripping my digestive tract and not allowing it to work properly. Anyway, later I had a friend who I'd met in this organization who was maybe like 12 years old or something. He was kind of like an older brother in a way, but I got back in touch with him, and somewhere during this time, you know, I tried to work again, and everything ground to a halt. I was again, I was like in pretty bad physical pain, and not in just going, you know, like everything I've tried, nothing seems to work, and something is seriously wrong, and I didn't know what it was. Right about that time, one of his friends kind of came over and was talking about this book that he was reading, and this process of sort of a new kind of therapy that allowed you to get in touch with buried memories, body memories, whatever you'd like to call it, from childhood, and things that, you know, birth trauma even, you know, and to be able to process that. And I was hearing about this and it was kind of fascination, and my friend was kind of interested, but it was also scaring the shit out of me. And I didn't know why, but anyway, to make a long story short, we ended up getting, you know, experiencing this process, and I had the first few experiences of a complete release of this pain I was carrying that I didn't know that's what it was, but where it's like a full body experience of getting in touch with those early experiences that I had blocked, you know, from those first two or three years. What it turned out to be over time, you know, as it started to slowly unfold itself, it came out in little pieces, you know, in the form of like body memories, not so much for me like pictures, but full experience of something that, and my father's name, you know, but it came out in the form of like this daddy or Ada, like really early, you know, vocabulary. My brother's name, Dennis, you know, was coming out of me, you know, and reacting to being violently assaulted, you know, and sexually assaulted. And so it took maybe a year or so just to sort of accept that that's what it was, you know. There are other people who kind of witnessed it and kind of had the idea that, like, oh, you were sexually abused, you know. So in retrospect, it was higher power, you know, loving higher power kind of slowly allowing me to get in touch with that when I was able to, you know, and to begin to release some of that and to by feeling it, you know, but and I started to trust that process and saw that I could have needed to do on my own to kind of create a safe space, because I had a lot to process, and it was not going to be a one or two time thing, and I needed to just sort of, allow that process to continue and create a safe space for it. I right up, you know, around that time as well, I met a person who I called a sponsor and a mentor who had many years sobriety in AA, but was also in this process of emotional healing, you know, from this thing that I had found for myself, and we met, you know, in connection with that. But so she had the 12 steps and that kind of recovery behind, you know, under her belt and as a part of her life, and could also kind of see, help me, was ahead of me in the process, and can kind of take away some of the fear of the direction I was going, you know, and to trust the process, you know. And anyway, she was, you know, kind of the surrogate, you know, older sister, parent. She was 15 years older for many years, actually, and was, gave me this kind of unconditional love, and I was somebody that I could speak about this stuff, and she had a really deep understanding of the connection with childhood, you know, abuse and trauma with, you know, addiction and that kind of thing, and I began to discover little by little that I had some addictive patterns of behavior. I didn't mention earlier the man, the friend that I was connected with. As we sort of got into this therapy, he revealed to me that he was gay, and I think I'd sort of felt that, but I never didn't know it for sure. He wasn't acting on it previously, you know, but as things kind of unfolded, he kind of ended up seducing me and kind of initiating a sexual relationship, and which completely freaked me out. But I fell right into it without, I think, partially because I was, you know, I felt incapable of being with a woman without crawling out of my skin, you know, feeling that way. And he was in love with me, I guess you might say, or obsessed, maybe is a better word, but and in kind of making this relationship happen, and he convinced me that I was really gay, but I was afraid to admit it or acknowledge it to myself. And he even at one time had me call my parents and tell them I was gay, as if that was, thinking like that was the stumbling block. You know, I did that, believing somehow that that was true. And anyway, it was really crazy, but it was a pretty dysfunctional, you know, crazy relationship that kind of escalated, and he ended up getting leukemia. All this happened within like a year or something, and dying, you know. And I, at the end of that, I was like, you know, another sort of a bottom. I was a basket case, exhausted, because I was like taking care of him during this period. And he decided to go a non-traditional route for treatment, and it didn't work. And anyway, but afterwards, I connected with this female friend again, and she was the only person in my life at that time who could just hear me recount what happened. She hadn't seen me for a year or something like that, and say, you know what, you're like completely exhausted. You have no idea how exhausted you are. You just need to like totally rest, take yourself off the hook. I had all these relatives, you know, family or people telling me that I needed to get a job, I needed to do this and that, you know, and I was totally incapable of it. And I just sort of settled in. I got an apartment. She kind of helped me to do that, and told me how to go about that. I was pretty dysfunctional in the world. I never got that from my parents, you know, where I should have gotten it, how to open a bank account or things like that, you know. So I was learning all that stuff as a young adult. And at the same time, you know, in this recovery process, in this healing process from all this heavy-duty trauma, and sort of learning how to be social for the first time. You know, she kind of introduced me to her family and friends, and I kind of had an adopted family with her family, and became sort of a surrogate brother in a way. But it's amazing how I can look back in retrospect and see higher power, you know, kind of, you know, helping me through all that. But anyway, the healing process continued, and I little by little became aware of my addictive patterns of behavior. One of them was in the area of sexuality, and I won't go into the details, but I'll just say it was like, it was kind of hidden, covert behavior. I wasn't like a womanizer, you know. But it was addictive, and something I found a program for. I'd gone to this sponsor friend encouraged me to, you know, find any program, 12-step program. I mean, once, before I start doing that, she said, you know, you're as something like as compulsive or as sick or something as any alcoholic I've ever known. You need the 12 steps, and you need meetings, you know. And I fortunately listened to that and got myself to some meeting. I used to go to some like open AA meetings, but just I was fairly isolated. I didn't have a lot of friends, so the fellowship helped a lot, you know. And then I found ACA somewhere in the mid-80s when it first showed up in LA. It was not quite the program it is now with all the great literature and everything. But it was helpful to go to those meetings, and it just kind of reinforced the process I was already in, you know, and then it provided some fellowship and fellow travelers. We didn't use that term then, but anyway. And then later I found Al-Anon, I've been an Al-Anon member for many years, although lately I've been going to more ACA meetings. But I think this, you know, for me, the program for me is very simple, I would say the cornerstone of the most important thing to me is my connection with my higher power. And that's very simple. It's like I you know, throughout the day, my sponsor used to say, turn your day over at the beginning of the day. To the degree that I have that willingness to seek God's will, you know, in the morning or the beginning of the day or throughout the day, and by that it's just like a simple thing of like checking in with myself, kind of like without even words necessarily, just stopping, pausing momentarily, especially when I'm agitated or I'm feeling like driven, you know, in some way, or, you know, I'm like, because fear comes up every day, you know, when I wake up, and I think there were patterns to the abuse that happened. I think the worst stuff happened. I think, you know, it late at night, you know, going to bed is when I was vulnerable to my brother especially, but my father as well. And so I've continued in that process of you know, what for me that was given to me for trauma healing, which it sounds radical maybe, but it's being with those feelings, you know. So I don't, for me anyway, I don't attempt to, you know, what I've heard other fellow travelers recently talk about, use the expression dropping down, you know, from the head into the body. That's something that phrase came to me, or I may have heard it from my sponsor friend as well, but it describes when I'm obsessing, when I'm agitated, you know, it's usually, I mean, it's pretty much always, there's some kind of feelings going on there that are churning away, and it's like, and I'm in my head, I'm trying to grapple with it, you know. Something maybe has happened that triggers me. So when I'm able to just stop and find a safe space, maybe lie down and breathe into it and just let go into my body and allow those feelings to happen. The fear, I think, for all of us is that, you know, it, like if we ever go back, you know, back and allow ourselves to feel the intensity of those feelings, it'll never end, or it'll kill us, or we'll go crazy, we'll end up in an insane asylum or something. My experience has been that there's some kind of wisdom and intelligence, loving wisdom that knows how much of a, you know, whatever the pain is. I had a lot of terror, I had rage, I had grief, I mean, all the, you know, the full spectrum of feeling, and a lot of physical pain that needed, my body needed to sort of wake up. There's like layers of, there were layers of trauma that happened, and my body kind of shut down and tightened up against that. And so it's kind of, the process for me is kind of a reverse of that, but I've learned that I can trust that I only will get, you know, that wave of feeling that I can handle at a time, and then it just subsides, you know. So it may be very intense. I had some stuff coming up today, even right before the meeting, and so I, you know, for myself, learned that I just let that happen, no matter how much and how intense it is, and give myself a safe space where I can allow the full expression of that, but not. It's very different than, you know, there's talk on this subject about, like, you know, hitting something with a bat, and that kind of is a way of like getting out anger. I did some of that in the beginning when, you know, when I was in the beginning of this process for me, but it never quite got to the source. You know, the important thing for me, what I discovered is like right beneath that there's a layer of control with that, where you're kind of, you know, hitting something with a bat or punching bag or whatever it is, and it's probably maybe at times better than doing nothing, than stuffing it maybe, and, you know, but it doesn't quite resolve it. You know, I found when I did that, I felt afterwards I'd still be kind of agitated, and I, you know, part of this group I was with for a while, we used what they call batakas, which are these kind of like padded bats, and sometimes they encourage us to kind of get in fights with each other, but it never really got to the source. So anyway, the thing that has worked for me that is just my take on this subject of how to process PTSD or trauma, whatever you want to call it, some of these intense feelings that some of us have carried with us, is by fully being with it and allowing it, you know, letting go into it, which is the hardest thing to do in a way, because it's like it's reconnecting with the feelings of complete powerlessness, you know, a feeling like for me, a feeling like I did when I was, you know, one or two or three, you know, was a child, basically, when I had no ability to stop it. But there's a connection, it's almost like gears coming together, where the body is connecting with something that I didn't have a chance to feel back then. And it's, you know, now it's decades later, and I'm safe, and it can process that pain, and it has this honest expression, you know, this truthful, completely spontaneous, it's what I would have expressed as a child if I could have, if it was safe to do that. And sometimes it's just pure, just the expression of pure pain, because that was it. That was what it felt like. It's the pure expression of that. But yet, when it flows, when that energy has a chance to just move and flow, it doesn't go on forever. It comes in a wave, you know, like a wave that sort of washes over you, and and it subsides, and it may come again a couple of times, and then it's like it's done, you know, for that day or that week or whatever. And so that, you know, the change that is the thing I talked about before, about, you know, my early experience with being in a state of terror, both being in front of people, or, you know, playing music in front of people, being with a woman, you know, alone, being in an intimate situation. Those two things and other things, dancing is something I never used to do, and now I've, you know, discovered for many years now, but those things have opened up to me in a way that they were impossible before, you know, and finding myself like having like a new experience of playing music for people or whatever, or being in an intimate situation and not feeling like I'm crawling out of my skin or having to, you know, shut down and close off inside. So I'm still that's an ongoing process, because I think, you know, what I discovered is that, you know, that the degree of trauma, the age that it happened for me, was, you know, the foundation of my life, and there was a reason I blocked it from my memory, or it was blocked from my memory by God and nature, you know, to help me, allow me to survive. So it doesn't, you know, I may be dealing with that for the rest of my life on some level, but it doesn't matter to me. The point is, it's like, take it a day at a time, and that in combination with these spiritual principles of the program, the 12 steps, and you know, my connection to my higher power, it all kind of works together for me, and the fellowship, and then seems like part of the makes the process move forward is like, you know, the leading of higher power into the areas where I'd previously maybe been afraid, you know, my discomfort zone, I call it. And just not to sort of push that, but to be open to it, and then let it, you know, be willing, my willingness to, you know, to me it's just about surrendering to higher power's will, or being open to something new that might scare me, and then I get a chance to do that, but also process the feelings around it, and in that process it becomes something that, like, becomes comfortable or becomes possible. And so anyway, that's sort of I would say, you know, my connection to my higher power, though, is the thing that makes everything possible, you know, and that on a given day lets me know what I need to take care of myself, you know, that thing we talk about in Al-Anon and ECA, and like, it's the next right thing, you know. I'm uncomfortable and just check in, I get an intuitive feeling of like, oh, what do I need to do, you know? Do I need to be with those feelings and process? Do I need to go for a walk? Do I, you know, I need to go to a meeting? You know, I have to call somebody? Or it lets me know what exactly what I need to do if I'm willing to kind of sit with it for a little bit until the answer comes. So anyway, trying to think how to wrap this up. I don't think if there's anything more I wanted to say before I'm probably out of time. This song came to me. I don't get a lot of original music, but it's a love song. But it's the words came out in the form of higher powers speaking. It's sort of it's called Divine Love Song. It's the unconditional love. It's kind of like we would all, you know, want to experience, but probably no human being is capable of. But it's just expressing that to us, to God's children, I guess you could say. So with that, I'll sing and play this song.
Unfading.
forever, my love for you will never change. I'll dry your tears, take your fears, I'll stay with you. I will never go away. I will be beside you to comfort you and guide you. Always and forever, my love for you will never change. Ooh.